I was thinking about today's text, and a story stood out in my mind, one that I had heard before, and it's the very first page I ever read the book of What's So Amazing About Grace. In the very first page, Philip Yancey, he relates a story that his friend had told him once, his friend was a pastor. He said, a prostitute came to me in wretched straits, homeless, sick, unable to buy food.
Her two-year-old daughter, through sobs and tears, she told me she had been renting out her daughter, 2 years old, to men interested in perversions. She made more renting out her daughter for an hour than she could earn on her own in an entire night. She had to do it, she said, to support her own drug habit. I could hardly bear hearing her story. For one thing, it made me legally liable. I'm required to report cases of child abuse. I had no idea what to say to this woman. At last, I asked if she had ever thought of going to a church for help. I will never forget the look of pure, naive shock that crossed her face. Church, she cried. Why would I ever go there? I was already feeling terrible at myself. They just make me feel worse. And then this is what Philip Yancey says about that story, that encounter. He says, what struck me about my friend's story is that women, much like this prostitute, fled toward Christ, not away from him. The worse a person felt about herself, the more likely she saw Jesus as a refuge. Has the church lost that gift? Evidently, the down and out who flocked to Jesus when he lived on earth no longer feel welcome about his followers. What has happened? What has happened? This morning, we're going to look at that question. What has happened? What's going on? What is Jesus's kind of a relationship with these sorts of people, with all people? We're going to look at it today through the calling of one of his followers, through the calling of Matthew. So again, if you haven't opened your Bible yet, open it to Mark 2. Mark 2. Last week, we looked at the first 12 verses of Mark, and we saw that he had all this authority, and kind of almost in a way culminating in this authority that he is indeed God, and he does have the ability to forgive sin as God. He has authority over it. That was verse 10. And then here, verses 13 to 17, it's going to show us who that forgiveness is given to. Who is it given to? So look at verse 13 of Mark 2. And he went out again by the seashore, and all the people were coming to him, and he was teaching them. As he passed by, he saw Levi, the son of Alphaeus, sitting in the tax booth, and he said to him, "Follow me." And he got up and followed him. And it happened that he was reclining at the table in his house, and many tax collectors and sinners were dining with Jesus and his disciples, for there were many of them, and they were following him. When the scribes of the Pharisees saw that he was eating with sinners and tax collectors, they said to his disciples, "Why is he eating and drinking with tax collectors and sinners?" And hearing this, Jesus said to them, "It is not those who are healthy who need a physician, but those who are sick. I did not come to call the righteous, but sinners." We're going to see three things here. We're going to see first a scandalous call, and then a scandalous gathering, and then finally, a scandalous truth. A scandalous call, gathering, and truth. So first, this scandalous call. Jesus, after he healed this paralyzed man lowered through the roof, he went down to the Sea of Galilee, and then he returned, he taught some people there, and he returned. And on his return, he passed by a tax booth, Levi's tax booth. There's really sparse information given about Levi. We just kind of get his name, his occupation. We have some words that are said to him, and then we have his response to those words. That's pretty much it. We don't get a whole biography of Matthew. So with this limited information, why is that interaction so scandalous? Why is it so kind of odd for Jesus to do this? Well, Matthew is not an ordinary man. Matthew is a member of the Israelite IRS, the Roman IRS, much worse than the IRS that we have today. Tax collectors were among the most hated and despised people in all of Israel. They were hated. No reputable rabbi would speak invitingly to someone that was a tax collector, or not even close, want one of them for a follower. Jesus, he shattered these stereotypes. Why were they so hated, these tax collectors, besides the idea that, I don't know if tax collectors are ever going to be the most popular people, but why were they so hated? Well, at this time, due to the Roman occupation of Israel, they needed to collect taxes for Rome. They needed to pay taxes to Rome. And Galilee, which was the specific kind of region in Israel that Jesus was in and that they were in, it was controlled by Herod Antipas. And Herod, to collect taxes, franchised out. He gave tax franchises out to people to collect taxes to the highest bidder. And these Jews that purchased these tax franchises, they were required to meet kind of a specific quota. They had to collect so many taxes, and anything that they collected over was kind of their wage. That was surplus they could keep for themselves. And back then, you can imagine kind of how this would work out. Tax collectors always kind of exploiting, squeezing people, trying to get as much money as they could, because if they get beyond their quota, that they get to keep. And so they hire thugs, hire all sorts of sketchy characters to collect the money from people that owe them to make the job done. And so it feels a little bit, thinking about Matthew, it's almost like a mob boss, like shaking people down for the money that they owe and trying to get more and more and more out of people. And back then, there was taxes on virtually everything was taxed. There was taxes for everything, and so there was ample opportunity for people like Matthew, other tax collectors, to take advantage of people. There was the poll tax, income tax of 1%, land tax, which is 1/10 of all grain and 1/5 of all wine and fruit. Taxes were levied on the transport of goods, on produce. For the use of roads, you had to pay for taxes. Crossing bridges, pay some taxes, and all sorts of other random activity. So you can imagine just taking a walk if you are on the road, or if you have to go over a bridge, or if you have to transport some goods, you're all of a sudden you're calculating how much taxes you're going to be owing. It gets up there pretty quick. Tax collectors were notorious for the exploitation of people, charging more than was necessary, under threat of harm. If you don't pay what I say you owe me, Rome's coming after you. Something's going to happen. And if they don't pay, maybe loaning money to them at an extremely high interest rate. Taking this even further, thinking about what the Jews would think about what Jesus does here and calling out to Matthew, calling out to this tax collector, they were considered traitors, taking money from family, from neighbors, and they were giving that money to a foreign oppressor for their own personal financial gain. They were classed among thieves, turncoats, liars. They were forbidden to sit as judges or to testify in a court. They were expelled from the synagogue. They could not go into the synagogue, and they caused their family disgrace. And in fact, it was said that Jews were told that they could lie to tax collectors with impunity. Thinking about Matthew, given the location of his tax booth, he's probably in Capernaum. There was a thriving fishing industry. So it's likely his booth is there as people go to the Sea of Galilee, then come back into Capernaum. They pay their tax on fish to Matthew. That would have meant that Matthew, perhaps, was one of the most known people in Capernaum and one of the most hated people in Capernaum. Jesus wasn't deterred by the social stigma, though. He stopped by the booth and he looked at him and said, "Follow me." That must have been absolutely shocking to Matthew, to the people, to the disciples. "Follow me? Are you kidding me? The people, we've been following Jesus and listening to him, and he's telling that to a tax collector. We hate that guy. Why would he want him to follow him?" But here's the difference. Here's what makes this call scandalous in one sense, but then not really all that scandalous in another. As people, we look at what we can see. We look at the outside, and people, when they looked at Matthew, they saw a detestable traitor, vermin, someone maybe less than human. He was useless. He's good for nothing. He's hated. That's what people saw, and that's what made this call of Jesus scandalous. But in another sense, Jesus knew more about this man than anyone else knew. He looked beyond the outward. He saw his heart. He saw someone who was weighed down by the guilt of his transgressions, by his sin, by his mistakes. He was wretched inside. He was ready to repent. In fact, Matthew is the very type of person that Jesus came for. The very type of person that Jesus came for. Let's look at him for a moment. He gets up and follows Jesus. That's pretty simple. There's no further explanation given beyond that. But according to Luke 5:28, when he did that, it says he left everything behind and followed Jesus. He left everything behind and followed Jesus. Up to this point in his life, Matthew had been a man of the world. He was all about his possessions. He was all about squeezing from people. He was all about himself. It was a self-centered, self-exalting life that he lived. But in that moment, maybe a little before, maybe after, we don't quite know, but in that moment, Matthew was transformed from a lover of money into a lover of Christ. He left it all behind to follow Jesus. Here in front of our eyes, an extortionist, traitor, an outcast, transformed into a disciple. And this sort of thing continues to happen over and over and over again. The least likely people turn into followers and disciples of Jesus. When I say the king of cool, who's the king of cool? Steve McQueen. Many of you probably watched his movies before. I grew up watching Papillon and The Great Escape. Those are good ones. I love The Great Escape. But he was known at the time as one of the biggest movie stars in the world. All the money, all the houses, all the fame and glory, women that he wanted, could have. Hobbies, cars. He loved to race cars. But what most people don't know is that months before Steve McQueen was diagnosed with the cancer that would eventually take his life, months before that, so he was in his right mind, he decided to follow Christ. Steve McQueen did. His life was immediately changed. He said before he died that he desired to change some people's lives with what I know of the Lord and what I have to offer with what's happened to me. And one of his regrets he said before he died was that he wanted to tell more people about God. 4 days before he died, November 3rd, he got to meet the man he most wanted to meet in the world at that time, Billy Graham. Billy Graham went to him. He was very sick and was going for treatment. And Billy spoke with him about his cancer and prayed with him. And before he left, Billy turned around and handed him his own personal Bible. And on the inside, it was written, "To my friend Steve McQueen, may God bless and keep you always." 4 days later, after two heart attacks, he died in a hospital bed, and they found him clutching Billy Graham's Bible. Steve McQueen, king of cool, bowing down. The first thing this text tells us is that this scandalous call of Jesus often involves those who are least likely, the people that most seem most unlikely to do his will, the people that we think are furthest from his kingdom. He breaks into their lives. He draws them to himself. He rips off these habits of sin and decay and things that are in their lives, and he transforms them into new creatures. The second thing that I think stands out to me is this remarkable grace. Remarkable grace. Remember, these people knew a lot about Matthew, and they hated him. How much must have Jesus known about Matthew? A lot more than everyone else looking from the outside. Jesus knew the thoughts in his heart. Jesus knew what was in his heart. Jesus saw all of it. And yet, follow me, Matthew. Follow me. Gordon MacDonald once said this. He said, "The world can do almost anything as well as or better than the church. You don't need to be a Christian to build houses or feed the hungry or heal the sick. There is only one thing that the world cannot do. It cannot offer grace." If you are a Christian, it means Jesus has approached you and said, "Follow me," and you've followed him. You are no different from Matthew, no less evil. He's shown you grace. He said, "Come and follow me. There is peace. There is rest." Radical grace that forgives when it's wrong, that blesses when it's cursed, that heals when it's hurt. Grace always seeking for the good of the other, always in kindness, always in gentleness. It's something that only the church can give the world. because only the church has received it. We have received his grace, and so we pass it on to those who don't deserve it because we were people who didn't deserve it. We forgive because we have been forgiven. Remember Jesus' call in your life and extend that to others. And this is what Monument in Colorado Springs needs, because right now we are in a time that is so tense. It's like everyone is just waiting to punch somebody. Like, we're so tense. And you have something like that happened yesterday in Pittsburgh, where a man walks into a synagogue and murders 11 people. Says, all Jews must die, and starts shooting. How does the church respond to that? What do we do? Oh, that's so evil. I hate that man. What do we do? We remember. We put on the grace that we have received. We hold it over our hearts. And then we respond. We remember how much we have been loved by Christ. Following this scandalous call, we see a gathering of some very scandalous people as well. Verse 15, I'll read it again. And it happened that he was reclining at the table in his house, and many tax collectors and sinners were dining with Jesus and his disciples, for there were many of them, and they were following him. If one is bad, two are worse. And here there's many sinners and tax collectors gathered following Jesus, the dregs of society. From the perspective of the self-righteous, the Pharisees, this is the worst of the worst people that Jesus has gathered with. It calls them tax collectors and sinners. And when they say sinners, they don't mean someone who's transgressed God's moral law. Like, these aren't people who have necessarily done that. They all have, but that's not what the Pharisees mean when they call them sinners. What they mean is these are people who don't take our religious traditions seriously enough. They don't hold them as strictly as we do. These are sinners. They take the traditions lightly. And it's kind of like, I was thinking about what that's like. It'd be like a Baptist calling someone a sinner because they didn't bring something to the potluck. And I kid a little bit about that, but I think you get the point. It's calling someone sinner because they haven't stood up to my expectations, my religious traditions that I have created. They're not following it, therefore they're sinners. But what made this people particularly scandalous, this group, was that Jesus shared a meal with them. In first century Israel, sharing a meal together, that was a statement of social acceptance. That was a statement of friendship. It was a lot more that you can eat meals with all sorts of people you don't like. In first century Israel, there was a lot more social dimension going on to it. It was acceptance. It was friendship. We have to think that Jesus is operating off of a different truth, something different than the Pharisees were. In Mark 2, there are these moments of conflict. Over and over again, something happens. Jesus does something or says something, and the Pharisees, they get all riled up, and there's this conflict. And Jesus is using this over and over again, not for conflict's sake, not to rile people up, but he uses that to reveal truth. So each time he reveals something that's true over against the false theology of the Pharisees, the false beliefs of the Pharisees. Last week, through conflict, Jesus revealed that he is God and that he has the authority to forgive sins. Again, like I said, this week, through this conflict, Jesus is going to show, he's going to reveal again exactly who that forgiveness is mediated to, who it's given to. And this is a scandalous truth. Scandalous truth. Verse 16, I'll read it again. When the scribes of the Pharisees saw that he was eating with the sinners and tax collectors, they said to his disciples, "Why is he eating and drinking with tax collectors and sinners?" They don't like what Jesus is doing. The Pharisees expected Jesus to follow their legalistic expectations, their legalistic traditions, and he just didn't fit the mold. So they got angry. They got resentful. And we almost have to step back and look at the mind and the life of a Pharisee to why this might be. There were various religious groups in Israel. There were Essenes and Zealots and Sadducees and Pharisees.